This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Ian McKelvey,
Jane Bolton, Alison Meldon,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Ian, you are an ex-mayor of Manawatu and now MP for
the Rangitikei.
For the Rangitikei. But you've got a long period of experience. You were born in this area.
So I was born in the Palmerston North Hospital in 1952, so quite a while ago. And I've lived here, obviously, all my life. In fact, I tell people I've lived on the same road all my life, and I probably have, although I've shifted 10 k's down Tangimarana Road now. My son's moved me on, which is not a bad thing to have happen, because the previous two generations who'd lived in our house had been carried out in a box. And so I at least walked out of the house.
So when did your family first come to this area?
So there's some debate about that, but about 1845 came to Flockhouse in 1845.
And
my great-great-grandfather, he came from Australia, and how he got to Australia, I'm not quite sure. There's a lot of stories about him, and some of my relations have had much more picturesque stories than I will. But he did end up in Australia, and while in Australia, he supplied the gold mines, basically, with meat. Came to New Zealand and obviously went farming. And certainly the earliest records, I think, of Flockhouse are 1851, but he'd lived in Wellington for some time before he moved to Flockhouse. Yeah. And so we've effectively been there since 1851, I think. And then my great-grandfather had a brother, and the two of them... One lived on the Flockhouse side of the river, which is the Rangitikei side of the river. The other one came across the river and set up at Pukemarama, which is where my family still live today. And so we shifted there in 1870 from the other side of the river. So we turned from Rangitikei people into Manawatu people.
Yeah. So was this all clearing the bush from scratch?
No, I don't think any of it was clearing the bush from scratch. So certainly on the Manawatu side of the river, there were quite a number of early settler families had been there before us, including a number who are related to my family, and the Scott family being the most, or Mackenzies and Scots being the most obvious of them. And so Scott's Ferry originated out of that Scott family, and my great-great-great-grandmother ran the ferry.
That's the one that's been restored and is available to...
They've restored the kind of place it sits on the side of the road. Yeah. So as you drive into Scott's Ferry, it sits on the side of the road there.
Yeah.
The old original ferry does. And the fact, I think the old original ferry bell may well be in our garden at Pukemarama. History doesn't really relate as to whether it's exactly the same bell or not, because they've also got a bell at Scott's Ferry. So there's a little bit of story about that. And so my great-grandfather married an Amon, and my great-grandfather married a Scott, and so that's the relationship to the Scott family, who are still around today. And Ian,
when you say an Amon, that's related to the racing Amon.
So Chris Amon was the great-grandson of that family, yes, and so Nio was his father. Nio Amon was a very good golfer, New Zealand amateur champion, and he also raced some very good racehorses. Chris went off to Europe and drove racing cars, and then came back to New Zealand and actually raced a few horses himself before he moved to Taupo.
And worked
for Toyota. In fact, his son, one of his sons, James, runs the Massey Fitness Centre and runs all
the sports complex at
Massey. And so I've backed up to him last week. And so that's the Amon connection. And then... As I said, the next generation married a Scott, and both families had six daughters, and so you can imagine there's a lot of relations around the Rangitikei particularly. And so if you go up the Rangitikei River, most of the families are related to us in one form or another, or we're related to them, however you want to put it. Some we claim, some we don't. Some they claim us and some they don't. But that's how it works. And so, you know, so all the Duncan families and the Bull families and the Hammonds and Rose are all relations of ours up the Rangitiki River. So all those old families up there married a daughter.
So the farming communities in this area are really quite close-knit and connected.
So up that part of the Rangitiki, they certainly are, not so much so in the Manawatu, although my mother came from Fielding, and she was a half Conway, half Burrell, and if you look at those families, then they're related to every here in the Manawatu, and every, so the northern Fielding, my mother's related to just about everybody, and in the Rangitiki, my father was related to almost everybody there, so it's quite an interesting connection. But then we don't have the same connections that... that some people around Fielding have, which are very much local, I suppose, and go back a long, long way. Our connection with the area is slightly different. But so that was an advantage to me in some ways, and a disadvantage in others is in my political life, I guess, particularly.
Yeah. I came from overseas and came to the university, so all my early exposure here was to a lot of people who were sort of first generation in New Zealand. And Is there a major difference between the long-standing local families and all this massive influx of people from elsewhere?
I don't think so. I don't think you see the difference that you see in places like Dunedin and Southland, particularly Canterbury.
Yeah.
I think that we're much... The Manawatu's very... We're very fortunate, the Manawatu, in my view, even Hawke's Bay, if you think about it from that perspective. I think our community's very integrated, and it's interesting if you look at Palmerston North, and the ethnic mix in Palmerston North, completely different than the rest of New Zealand, other than Auckland.
Yes.
And in that way, I think we're quite fortunate. So I don't think we have any of that kind of sort of feeling of superiority, you might say, in the Manawatu. I think we're fortunate in that area. And you know, if you looked at the Festival of Cultures they had on Saturday in Palmerston North, there was something like 60 different countries represented there, and 32 ambassadors turned up in Palmerston North on Saturday. That's pretty spectacular.
Yes.
And so it just shows what an accepted part of the community that our very diverse cultures are now compared to some other parts of New Zealand. So we're lucky in that respect.
Yeah. I think a lot of the those coming in just aren't aware of the depth of history that there is locally, though.
Well,
for me.
Yeah.
I always remember, because we were Toyota dealers for a long time in the Manawatu, or part of the Toyota dealership in the Manawatu, and Mr. Toyota, who, funnily enough, Toyota's not run by Toyotas, it's run by Toyotas, he came and looked at our old house that we lived in once, and he just could not believe it. When you think of Japanese, like, their history is so long and ours is so short, but actually the timber in our house, or in these old houses, is thousands of years old in some cases, and they couldn't believe the amount of it. And so we have a different kind of history than the rest of the world have. But because we're a very recently settled country, I guess the Maori certainly have some history, and the Moriori more so. But from a New Zealand perspective, some of the stuff we do has got a long, long history.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
So growing up here, what was your experience of that? Is it you went to a rural school?
I was born on a farm, basically, and I was going to be a farmer from the day I was born, I think. A farmer who rode horses probably from the day I was born, so I never had any intention of doing anything else. Went to Clydesdale School, which is a little school that's long since closed, although our three children went to Clydesdale School, and I was just talking about it this very day actually to one of our neighbours who was dropping it. I dropped one of my grandchildren off at the school bus on my way into Fielding this morning, and we were talking about the fact that my father went to Carnarvon School, which was around the corner, long since closed. We went to Clydesdale School, long since closed, but our children were three of the last five kids.
Very much one teacher school
and went to school. I shouldn't call a horse a mongrel, but she wasn't a very pleasant sort of a horse, and she was great to get to school on, but when you got her to school you couldn't catch her. And we had one principal who was not really into catching a horse for us, so we spent ages down on the sort of plantation, I suppose, where the pony lived, trying to catch this blooming thing to get us home. Julia, her name was, she was a bit of she was definitely not a friendly soul when it came to catching him, but she was a nice pony to ride. So no shoes, on wooden metal track, metal roads, and rode to school. People don't.
What, you had no shoes, or the horse had no shoes?
No, the horse had no shoes. I can't remember whether I had shoes or not. I'm pretty sure I would have had, but I noticed my granddaughters seem to go around with no shoes on now. So the fashion's reversed.
Yeah. We did record one person who said her mother insisted the first 2 weeks of school she had to wear shoes so that others could know that they could afford shoes. After that, bare feet was fine.
So Clydesdale School was a very small school in those days. And
Where was it, Ian? Clydesdale, just
a kilometre down the road from where we lived, or a mile down the road from where we lived. So we lived on the corner of Rosina Road and Tangwana Road when we were kids, and then and it was a mile down the road. So the Clydesdale School towards Bulls, and then went on from there to Huntley School, and which was a was in those days a boys' boarding school, prep school for boys.
Yeah. At what age?
In Martin, went there at the age of 9, or perhaps even might have been 8, but I was certainly 4 years there. And it was an old, there's not one piece of it left that was original, I don't think.
Was that enjoyable? Yeah.
Well, I like the sport. So I guess the sport was the key to going to Huntley, and I remember the teachers and you can't forget them. Yeah.
And the move was because with a bigger school you get better education?
Well, I think that my grandfather and father had both gone on to Huntley School we got sent there, us boys.
That was an Anglican school, wasn't it? It was made for the farming community who were too far away to get to school.
That's right, it was certainly an Anglican school.
Yes, and isn't half the chapel still original?
The chapel would be original, they've added a little bit on. Yeah, that's quite right, Jane. The chapel is original. I think it's a very good school and gives you a great grounding and all sorts of things. And nowadays they have girls there as well, which is even...
It's private fee-paying school.
Yeah, it's very much private fee-paying school, very expensive at the moment as well.
Did you move on from there?
Went to Wynoo Collegiate. Did nothing but play sport there as well.
So was that sort of farming communities, if they could afford it, they'd send their... sons to Huntley and on to Wanganui.
In those days, both of those schools were very much farming orientated. In recent years, much more Palmerston North, particularly in Huntley's case, a large percentage of the kids at Huntley come from Palmerston North now. And Wanganui turned into a much more or much less rural school than it was in my day. Although it's very interesting, I was at an event there on Saturday night, and it's reversed completely back to rural. Not completely, but a large percentage of people at those schools are now rural, and for the very reason that Jane said, it's just so hard to get to school from a lot of the places they live in. And so the other interesting thing for me is, and it's very challenging, and I've found it in my political life really, is that our small rural secondary schools are very challenged for a lot of reasons, and not because of the quality of the teachers, but because they're so small, they don't have sports teams, they can't make up. They don't have the resource that the city schools have, and so there's a move, a strong move from a lot of those communities for those children or those kids that need to go to secondary school to go to Tandler School.
The change in the nature of farming, isn't it? Lower populations in rural areas now, larger farms?
Yeah, I think to some extent that's right. And so you look at schools like Taiapiri Area College and Taumarunui High School, which both have very light roles. I mean, in fact, I think Taiapiri Area College is the smallest school, or maybe Aokuni is the smallest one. Ruapehu College in Aokuni, which I think has only got about 140 or 150 secondary school children. And so it's very challenging for them to do anything, really. And so you get more and more kids leaving the area, and that compounds the problem.
Yeah.
And so they're either going to the Fielding High School, where there's a boarding establishment, which is well over popular, in fact, the waiting list for it. Or they go to schools like Wynoo Collegiate, which is now integrated, and so consequently is a little bit more affordable than it used to be. I think it's a shame that we don't have more boarding schools, because I think boarding schools for those kids is a great asset. And I notice one of my granddaughters would rather stay at school than go home, because I think the school's slacker than a mother is. So I find that quite interesting.
Was the royal connection a boost for Wanganui Collegiate?
I don't think so. I think Edward, I remember him coming down to, and we had the Savile Cup polo tournament on our farm, actually, when he was at Wanganui, and he came down there to that. And I don't know. I think that at least he's sort of held his own in the world, hasn't he? His brother's not quite so reliable.
He wrote that book, didn't he? Wrote a book with some of the students from Collegium.
Yes, he did.
It's a neat book.
And I find him quite interesting because I always remember the next one, Prince Andrew, was president of the Royal Agricultural Society of the Commonwealth when I was president of the Royal Agricultural Society of New Zealand. And I always remember him asking my wife what we did. And she said, we're farmers, of course. He had no idea what a farmer did. She couldn't believe that he could be president of the Royal Agricultural Society of the Commonwealth and know as little as he did about it. He obviously knew about some things in life, but nothing like his brother, who is clearly he's a very keen agriculturalist, and he does things a little differently than some of us do. But he, you know, I've been to his farm, and
farming in the UK is quite different from
very different.
Is it even the scale and?
Yeah. But it's interesting how the. I mean, I think that just talking about the royal family, I think they're very. I think they're good for New Zealand, and I think. Even though they're slightly eccentric, one or two of them, and slightly badly behaved, one or two of them, I do think that they kind of do stuff they do good for the world, basically. And I think it's good.
Yeah. Okay.
They employ a lot of people. That's good.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good employment.
So, now, given that we're sort of talking about farming, you worked on the family farm and.
So once I left school, I went to the Waikato. And worked for a bloke called Peter Levin, who was my godfather. Peter used to live, his father and mother lived at Sanson, actually. And he had a farm at a Hinawai in the Waikato, which was bought by the New Zealand coal mining outfit to mine, actually. But he kept leasing it for years because they never mined it. They still haven't, they won't. And so I worked for him for a while. And his wife was a Horton from Wilson and Horton of New Zealand Herald. So he could afford a farm. And I think that was a great experience for me working for someone else. Then I came back to Massey University, where I did very little but go to the races. As an ag student, and failed a diploma. Although I did fail a diploma because the day of the exam started, I got knocked out on a horse and broke my arm, and that's why it looks like that. And spent a few days.
Didn't give you an agri-tap pass, though.
No, they didn't. Probably with very good reason. But interestingly, my father went to Massey University as well. So did my sister, who was a vet student. And the other interesting thing about us, my brothers will kill me for this, but my two brothers and I all dropped out of Massey University without success, which is quite interesting. And our sister passed probably with the brightest honours you could get. Then two of my children have gone to Massey University, so we've got a very long history of Massey in our family. And so I think it's a great asset to the Manawatu, and I'd love the place. And you know, when you think about it, it's the only proper university campus that we've got in New Zealand, and it's unique. And I was there last week, and the kids, but I call them kids, of course, but they're not. The young people that are there just think it's amazing because it is an extraordinarily. Great lifestyle. And we lived in B Block, of course, which was a rat infested old ex-army barracks. It's very interesting. It's now up on Mount Stewart as someone's house, but it used to have all these rooms in it, and there was holes in the walls. it was quite entertaining. Yeah. And of course, that was probably our first introduction as young people to a large ethnic different community, and the Colombo Hall was just down down the alleyway from where we lived, and it was very interesting.
And Colombo Hall was for all the
Colombo Hall was effectively built as a result of what was known as the Colombo Plan, which I think, if I'm right, was a plan to integrate Asia and New Zealand Asia and the Western world, basically. As it's turned out for New Zealand. Very fortunate.
There are lots of connections overseas from that.
Absolutely, yeah, and now our New Zealand, and New Zealand is hugely dependent on Asia now for our export markets and for our life. Actually,
it took a long time to build up those connections because until the UK went into the EU, there was very much just a focus on it.
Absolutely. So I think that it was one of the changes that gave us a fright, but actually was very necessary. And it was equally interesting. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking to, I think it was Lord Devon, who I think is a trade expert in England. He was on a Zoom call with us, and he he got a bit of flack over the fact that the UK have really neglected New Zealand in the course of their free trade agreements they're now signing up to in Europe. And, and so he had no real answer to that. He was very nice about it, but he had no real answer to it. And I think that, I do think though that England leaving the common market will be great, or the European market will be great for New Zealand and great for the world. I think it will be great for England as well, actually. I think they're going to really find they can do stuff they couldn't believe they could do, provided the current government gets its head around it. I think it's a great opportunity. But yeah, so so that was the start of us getting into Asia, I guess, and it's certainly the place that, that's where our future is, supplying food into Asia, basically. And, and they'll supply in return. They sort of put the technology and the research and development and all that sort of stuff. They give us the opportunity in that area because they're good at it.
Yeah.
Were there many Asian students at Massey when you were there?
Oh, quite a lot, yes. I'm not sure how many people Colombo Hall took, but that was full of basically overseas students.
Do you know what countries they tended to come from?
They came from a large number of those early ones from Singapore and places like that, but the Philippines, they were from all over the place. And of course now we've got the International Pacific College, or I don't think that's its proper name, but in terms
of
the IPU, which is a you know, that's been an interesting, it's been challenging to keep it afloat, I think, or keep it going, but I do think it's done a lot of good for New Zealand, a lot of good for Palmerston North. You know, 500 odd students, of which about 300 of them are foreign. It's very good.
To get back to your bank now, we said farming background. Was it sheep farming? Dairy, beef?
We were always sheep farmers who farmed, well, obviously beef as well, and a whole lot of horses, and grew a lot of grain in those days.
Obviously beef as well?
Well, I think that sheep and beef farms were probably, you know, I think all farms need a diversity of livestock, and I think the mix of sheep and cattle was an ideal one. But so I left Massey and went home probably when I was probably about 21. And I also got married very early, at 21. And I'm still married to the same person. And so, and her father...
As he said, he does what he's told.
Well, her father told me when I asked him, because I was one of those traditional people, I did ask if I could marry his daughter. He had four daughters and two sons, and I think he was pleased to get rid of one of them. Anyway, I asked him if I could marry, and he said, good boy, good boy. He said, if she ever comes home, I'll send her straight back. And that was the only bit of advice I got from him. I don't think she ever went home.
She's been a fantastic wife.
But yeah, anyway, so I was a bit lucky to get her. And at the moment, she's walking the South Island. She's walked the Himalayas. She's walked half of South America. She's walked a fair bit of Europe. And now she's walking the South Island because she can't get anywhere else, which is probably a good thing. But she's a keen walker, and she's been, you know, done a lot of touring. And I think we have an agreement, really. So since I left the farm and went into, I guess, what you'd call a political life, or I went off doing business stuff, actually, for a long time. I was on a few boards and then became a politician. I'm not really a politician, but I'll get onto that a little later. But she, we came to an agreement, I think, that she could do what she liked if I could do what I liked. And
you met her at university, did you? Or?
Yes, I did, but I took a sister to the races. She's got an identical twin sister. I took her to the races. She won't like me telling you this. I took her to the races in Whanganui, and she left me in the Turakina, in the Ben Nevis pub in Turakina, and I found the other one. They were identical.
And they didn't realise that?
Well, you could hardly tell in those days. You can now, because one's never married. And they're actually both walking the South Island together now. So they get on pretty well, and they've been around the world. They do all the stuff they do together. But yeah, so I married the other one, and Prudence never got married, and the name tells you all. And so we married. I was younger, so we married quite early, and we've been married for a long time. We had three kids, and now we've got eight grandchildren, and six of whom live on the farm, two in Hawke's Bay. So I went farming, and then my brother came home from university, my next brother. He went, we farmed together. In fact, we farmed together for 40 years, which is pretty unusual. And we sort of got on pretty well. We had the same aim in life, and our aim really was to preserve what was quite a significant family asset in one set of hands.
Was that through a family trust structure, or?
Oh, look, it was unbelievable. and the complications caused basically by the governments pre-Second World War and after the Second World War, and Britain had exactly the same problems with death duties and all sorts of taxes, and so there was all sorts of, in our case, probably about four or five trusts and certainly two or three companies set up to make sure that the government couldn't get their hands on you. And I don't think that was untypical of our rural New Zealand at the time. And we unwound the whole lot and put it together as one farming company, which it still is today. And my brother and I were, we bought our younger brother out at a very early stage, and he went off to Hawke's Bay. And we just set out with the aim of one of us acquiring the, what effectively was the family entity in due course, and my family were in that position. And have since done that, and although BJ's...
So you kept it as a unit in the company, and one person was able to end up owning all the shares, and
one family ended up owning the shares.
Yeah.
And that was always our intention, and it's going to be interesting to see what my two sons think of that, and they're getting on, they're going to have to make a decision soon, but that was where that intention from a very young age, actually, which was really quite interesting. So we were both fortunate, because he's done his own thing in his dairy farming life and done well on. Our younger brother, who we then brought home again much later, he came back home and worked at home for a while. His son now, interestingly, runs the dairy structure for my two brothers. So he came back from Hawke's Bay. He's now back in Hawke's Bay again, living over there.
The company structure wasn't really the typical one, was it? It was normally the trust.
Very unusual. And I think that I prefer a company structure, much easier. It's much more nimble and you've got a whole lot more control over what happens, and you can manage it in a much better manner. I think we'll see trusts to a large extent. The government's got its nips into trusts at the moment. I think we'll see trusts start to disappear, and some of the trust law is becoming quite onerous and actually doesn't give the protection that the old trust laws used to give. And I think I don't think it's necessarily good, but then at the same time, I think that you know, you can operate in a much better manner if you've got some decent corporate governance.
I was going to say, there's more of a corporatisation of farming now anyway, and larger and larger farms.
Yeah, I think that's unfortunate in a lot of ways. I think that we went down the corporate structure as a family, actually, and we've sort of backed off that it's not really all that successful in the farming environment, and mainly because our returns have never been good enough. Until capital gain was factored into it, and a lot of these big public companies or public entities are factoring capital gain into it, which is pretty poor when you think about it.
Yes,
because you've got to realise the capital gain. You've got to realise the capital gain before you get one. And so I don't think that we've never farmed for capital gain. It's not part of the game. And I think that we're lucky. Well, I was lucky to have two boys that wanted to farm, actually. Yeah. So either lucky or unlucky, depending on how you look at it.
Have to expand the farm to make it economic?
Well, no, we were probably big enough to be economic anyway, and that's how three of us lived off it for a while until we slowly attrition ended up with one of us operating. But our family operation's pretty large by most standards, and it's stood the test of time, and it's managed to get rid of all its sisters and brothers out of the system without destroying it, which is the big challenge for farming families. Is to, well, four of us, luckily in my family there's only three, two boys and a daughter who lives in Hawke's Bay, and so it's quite challenging if you want to remain intact as a family unit.
We're just about at time, but while we're still on the sort of early days and so on, one thing to throw in, especially now you've moved into politics, but there was the Vietnam War. You would have been fairly young during that time. Was that something that was significant?
No, it was never significant in my life. Like, the two things that went past me, really, were the Vietnam War and the Springbok Tour stuff. I never really took part or I didn't have a strong opinion on those sort of things.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, for someone who's ended up with nearly 20 years of political life, I wasn't really at all interested in any of that stuff. It didn't remotely interest me. I was really just a farmer who wanted to farm. And I think it's later in life that you realise that unless someone does something about something, then you're going to have what you don't necessarily want in life. And one of the things I wanted to preserve in life was the life I'd had. I think I was, we were very fortunate growing up in New Zealand, and I think that I want to ensure that my grandchildren and their children were fortunate growing up in New Zealand as well, and that's what drove me into politics. But you know, none of those things really touched me much.
Ian, when your grandparents first started off, what was the farm like? Did it have flax and
There were flax mills. So there were flax mills on our country in the early days. Some of the relics of those flax mills are still there. And it's kind of intriguing that that one of the modern industries in New Zealand is the hemp industry, which is really just an extension of the flax industry. We still have flax swamps on our place. We've preserved all of those sort of things. We're pretty much into preservation of what was. We haven't bulldozed sand hills, as you've seen a lot of that go on in New Zealand. We're very much sand country. We've planted trees on them, which of course ruins the look of them a bit, but we have a large number of pine trees and unfortunately pine trees, because nothing else will grow on that salt air. I'd rather not have a pine tree, but pine trees make money, and so that's what we do. And they also provide shelter.
Have there been other things on those hills before then?
No. Basically, I think that interesting thing about the Manawatu Coast is that the sand blew in and nothing else existed. So it wasn't until the planting of marram grass and things like that that stabilised it.
Yeah.
And that would have happened in the very early 1800s probably. And the flax swamps were there. Those have almost all since disappeared. And so as farms were developed, the swamps were unfortunately drained. Well, on Pukemaram we still have a number of those swamps, and we've got a couple of quite big lakes that still exist there. But you've got to maintain them, unfortunately, because they will fill up with sand and they will disappear.
Mm. Because actually a lot of the area from Palmerston North out to the coast used to be a large bay until it actually filled up. I mean, going back in thousands of years.
Oh, I think that's right. Well, of course, Palmerston's just a swamp. I shouldn't be so rude about them, but it really is a swamp. Fielding is too, actually. Yeah. And so the sand
country. There was all the mosquitoes for the early settlers.
Yeah, that's right.
We've not really talked about Flockhouse in 1845, the fact that there was development there as early as that. It would have been one of the first in the year.
Yeah, absolutely. It was beautiful silk country, of course, some of Flockhouse brought down by the Rangitiki River, and so that's a great advantage we've got in the Manawatu. It's all come out of the hills, and the best bit of the hills came down here. So we've got that amazingly fertile soil in a lot of the Manawatu, actually. And so it's a very interesting part of the world.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz. If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.